This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is jazz pianist George Shearing, whose playing has been praised for his chordal shadings and for what jazz critic Whitney Balliot described as his masterly touch. Shearing enjoyed his greatest commercial success in the 50s, although the quintet records he made at that time were regarded by most critics and some musicians as what later came to be known as easy listening music rather than jazz. Shearing broke up his quintet in the mid-70s. These days you're most likely to hear him playing with a bassist or accompanying singer Mel Torme. This is George Shearing and bassist Brian Torf, as recorded in concert, playing Shearing's best-known composition, Lullaby of Birdland. George Shearing was born in London in 1919 and was blind from birth. He studied classical music but was most inspired by the records of jazz pianists like Art Tatum, Fats Waller, and Teddy Wilson. In the 1940s, he was one of England's most popular jazz musicians, but after World War II, he decided to move to New York, the center of modern jazz. He became an American citizen in 1956. As a child, George Shearing studied piano at a school for the blind. I asked him if his teachers were confident that a blind person could master the piano.
I don't think it's a question of whether a blind child could master the piano as whether a blind child can make a living in anything other than playing in the pubs, which is where I started. You've got to remember one thing, Terry, and that is that if I chose, say, to be a studio musician, it's obviously necessary to read music. And yes, I can read Braille music, but that's not sight reading, sighted music. You might find 30 pages of manuscript paper with so many notes on it, just as if, you know, flies were all over it. And we always say that there are some sighted people who read so well that if a fly appeared on the paper, they'd read it, you know. This is not available to the blind. But playing in the pub was, and eventually getting my own group was. And from there, I went with an all-blind band. 15 blind guys learning to play instruments from being basket makers and chair caners. We were playing arrangements of Jimmy Lunsford and Duke Ellington and people like that.
How did you find each other? Who organized the band?
The National Institution for the Blind. People used to write all the parts out in Braille. I was the only one who didn't read his part. I could pick it up by ear because I learned a lot of the records as well. There were a couple of people in that band, the first trumpet player and the drummer, who had everything from, early Miff Mole and stuff like that, all the way through Teddy Wilson and Tatum and Fats Waller. And these people all kind of became my mentors, as you can imagine. So it was that was a really wonderful training ground.
Just as you were really coming of age and, well, you'd already started your recording career, the war came along. How was the music scene in London by the war? And was there any place to perform or even places to listen during the war?
I had more work than I could handle because there were so many people called up. I would be doing studio work in the daytime because there was enough of it that didn't demand reading, and they couldn't afford to be that fussy any longer. So I learned the charts and did the recordings and the jazz broadcasts and whatever was involved. I did theater, two shows in the theater, 8 and 10 at night. I went on to a supper club and played from 10:30 until about 1, 1:30. and then on to a nightclub and played till 4, and then back in the studios the next morning at 10. I had much more work than I could handle.
Were you ever bombed while you were performing during the war?
Oh, yes. First of all, my mother was bombed out 3 times. And I was in a cab one night going to work, and we stopped at a traffic light. And we heard this tremendous blast, and the cab shook like mad. And I said, boy, that was a close one, wasn't it? And there was no answer. And I said, that was a close one, wasn't it? I put my hand in front, and the driver's gone. He ducked in a doorway, and when it was all clear, he came out again. I said, thanks a lot.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, didn't you also do some playing inside air raid shelters during the
war? Oh, yes.
What kind of setup was that there'd be a piano there?
I met my first wife in an air raid shelter, and what we did, we played in the basement, which had been turned into a gymnasium. And there were kind of forms, you know, benches that one could sleep on or on the floor, and there were blankets and stuff. And there would be an upright piano there. So I was living with a song plugger at the time, and he and I would play four hands, much to the amusement of people that went, you know, down in that particular air raid shelter.
So you think it helped pass the time for everybody?
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, sure. I mean, you had to make a life. I mean, you had no alternative. 15 hours a day, the raid would be on. Day and night, until we defeated the day raiders.
My guest is pianist George Shearing. Well, after the war, you decided, I guess, not to stay in London, and you wanted to at least make a few trips to the United States. What was the lure of America for you?
I met a few American musicians just before and a few more during the war. And all as if they were in one voice, pretty well said, man, you should go over to the States. You kill them over there. Well, you know, I had acquired some ability to play in the styles of Teddy Wilson, Art Tatum, Fats Waller, and Bob Zirke, and people like that. But they had all this over here. You can't believe, when I first came over on the U.S., on the United States ship, I had letters to top flight agents. And I went around giving one audition after another. And they all said the same thing. Gee, go and build yourself into a $10,000 a week act. Come over and we'll handle you. One of them said, I wish I could play like that. What else can he do? And I know what they meant.
What?
They have all these things over here. They had Art Tatum. They had the American Art Tatum, the original. They had the American Teddy Wilson. They had the American Fats Waller. Why do they need English copies of these things? So it became very evident to me very quickly that what I needed was an identity. And the identity was, of course, the George Shearing Quintet.
Yeah, now, describe how you put that quintet together.
Well,
what was the inspiration behind it and the reason you chose that unusual instrumentation?
Well, that's thanks to Leonard Feather. But let me go back. I started playing as an intermission pianist in 1948. What fun that was. My goodness. I'll never forget when I first sat in with Charlie Parker. Being a reserved Englishman, I should have said, what would you like to play, Mr. Parker? But I was a 28-year-old hippie who came from England. I never dressed like a hippie in my life. That's not the point. But the point is, I did say to him, what do you want to blow, bird? And he thought, you know, he was a gentleman. He wasn't destructive. But I guess he felt it was necessary to put me through the paces and kind of just take me down a peg in case I became too cocky. And I'm sure he didn't think in this, other than to be good schooling for me. So when I said, what do you want to play, Bird? He said, oh, how about all the things you are in five sharps? I don't know whether you play any piano, Terry, but that's a difficult piece of music to play in B major. I did it. I had the background, and I did it. And it was passing a few of these tests and winning favor with the American musicians by ability, which stood me in good stead.
Let's get back to the quintet that you
organized. Right. I got off that, didn't
I? You were talking about how you figured out you needed an identity.
Yeah. Well, that was, I started, as I say, as a pianist. And then one time I was going to go into a club in New York. I think it was the Click Club, which later became, I don't know, it's Birdland. I was going into this club with my own trio. And the owner said, I have a chance to buy Buddy DeFranco at a very, you know, reasonable cost. Would you mind if I put him with him? Would I mind? It sounded like a Benny Goodman quartet or something once we got going with it. It's fabulous. Depending on whom you spoke to, whether Buddy's wife or my wife, it would be the George Shearing Buddy DeFranco quartet or the Buddy DeFranco George Shearing quartet. We've remained friends ever since, but we went our own separate ways. And Leonard Feather said, well, we have this marvelous rhythm section of John Levy on bass and Denzel Best on drums. He said, you've heard Marjorie Himes play with her own trio and with Woody Herman, and you've heard Chuck Wayne play with his own trio. Let's get it together and see what happens. So we got together, and they said, what do you want to play? I said, well, I don't know. You know, September in the Rain. 900,000 copies later on MGM, the quintet was born.
The group headed in pop directions in a lot of its records. What was your reason for choosing that?
Capitol Records wanted it. They wanted me to add strings and add this and add that. And there were a number of very successful records because of that. But we started to lose favor with the critics, as you can imagine, when we did that.
What about your jazz musician friends? What was their reaction?
Well, you know, some of them knew what I was doing. What I was doing was trying to broaden the listening audience for jazz. But the critics just felt I was going very commercial. And I met Dave Brubeck on the street one day, and I said, you just lost a poll. I said, I want to congratulate you. I said, because if you get some less favorable mention, you might be able to afford to hire a band boy. He said, I just did. You know, so it depends on what you want. I mean, how long do you have to be in a musical minority to prove your sincerity? Now, I went along with Capitol. They wanted it that way. But I did tire of it because my job as pianist and leader of the George Shearing Quintet was limited in scope. And in retrospect, the critics were right because there was a lot less creativity involved in the more commercial side of my music.
Is it why you broke up the quintet?
I just got tired of it. It was on automatic pilot. I could go to sleep playing the show. And I tried several things. I surrounded it with brass. I surrounded it with Latin sounds. And people loved that. But I could work all day long on a fugue or a very intricate piece of music. When I came to work, will you play Roses of Picardy? Play I Remember April. You could work all day long. This is what they wanted. And I'm glad they wanted it. But it's tiresome. And it's confining. It's as if you have fetters around your neck. You just can't move, you know. And so I finally wanted to address myself to the proposition of being a complete pianist rather than a band leader who rests on his laurels until he gets tired enough to go to sleep.
It seems to me that in the last few years, you've been adding more and more popular song to your repertoire, playing with singers like Mel Torme, singing yourself. You've recently, I think it's recently, began singing
as well. Yeah, within the last 10
or
15 years, you know, recently, yeah. by comparison with my career. This is my 50th year in show business.
What attracts you to a song when
lyrics, and how the lyrics fit with the music, you know, and being able to make literary sense out of the song. For instance, everybody, and I do mean everybody that I've heard, when they do Send in the Clowns, they sing, "Isn't it rich? Isn't it queer? Losing my timing this late in my career." Now, would you say it that way? Losing my timing this late in my career? You would say, losing my timing this late in my career, wouldn't you? But it's partly Sondheim's fault. I love him. I love him dearly. We had a long talk one night in the Carlisle about Bach. He's a great Bach enthusiast. But people have to use a little bit of imagination, a little bit of ingenuity. Isn't it rich? Isn't it queer? Losing my timing this late in my career. This is why I love songs.
I see what you mean with that. Did Sondheim agree with you?
I think so. In fact, I know he did. Yes. Yes, he agreed with me completely.
You've written songs as well, and I think your best-known piece is Lullaby of Birdland. Can you tell us the story behind writing that?
Birdland needed a theme song for a six-hour disc jockey show that they had in the early 50s.
And Birdland was a club in New York in the 50s?
Right. Yes.
Mostly bop musicians playing
it. Right, yeah. Well, it was named for Charlie Parker, see, whose nickname was Bird. So I wrote this thing. I heard it in my head. I wrote it in 10 minutes. I always say 10 minutes and 35 years in the business. Over a steak in my dining room when I lived in New Jersey. I went back to that same butcher 1,000 times trying to get that same steak again. So they liked it. And they played it every hour on the hour, which is, of course, why it became my best-known song, because Macfarlane is my only well-known song. When I go on as a composer, I said, I'd like to play you a medley of my hit, you know. But the thing is that when something is hammered through people's heads, like, of course it's going to, if it's got any substance at all that people can hang on to, of course it's going to become a hit, you know. And that's what happened with Lullaby. And, of course, we got over 100 people recording it.
I don't know if you wrote it with a lyric in mind or not, but
no.
I have heard it sung.
Yes.
And the first line is, I'm not going to sing it, maybe you'll do it, but they sing the first line with Lullaby of Birdland in it.
Yes, they do.
Do you want to just sing the line just to?
Yeah. Well, if you read it and you read it as if you're dividing the lines, you say, Lullaby of Birdland, that's what I always hear when you sigh. Never in my wordland could there be ways to reveal in a phrase how I feel. Well, doesn't mean anything, does it, really? So, Lullaby of Birdland, that's what I always hear when you sigh. Never in my wordland could there be ways to reveal in a phrase how I feel. Now, it means something because it's being read.
Did you, when you composed the song, hear the first phrase as being Lullaby of Birdland?
No. No. I just thought of this as a tune. And in fact, I'm not even sure that, I mean, it was a theme song for Birdland. I don't even remember who gave it the title of Lullaby of Birdland.
When you first started living in the States in the 40s and the 50s, the jazz scene was having, jazz musicians were really having a lot of drug problems. There was a lot of heroin that was being used among jazz musicians then, and a lot of young musicians, partially, I think, to emulate some of their heroes like Charlie Parker, ended up shooting up and getting hooked on drugs. Did you ever run into any problems with that or come close to it? Was it hard for you to keep out of that?
Oh, no. I I didn't drink, I didn't take a glass of wine until I was 46 years old. Never mind drugs or anything like that. I had people with me that took it. And provided they did their job, showed up on time and played as well as they would not. And that's a lot to ask. But if they could do it, it wasn't my business. I had a guy one night, and I'll protect him. I won't tell you his name. He called me about 3 o'clock in the morning. And he said, George, can I come up and see you for a minute? And I thought the manager had forgot to pay him or something, you know. So he came up. He sat on my bed. And he says, George. I said, yeah, Bob, what's the matter? I'm on drugs. And he cried. And I said, so you're on drugs? Now, what? What does that mean? And he told me that he didn't want to stay around long enough for the shame to mar my band and my reputation. And I said, when you are straight, your job will be there. Well, time went on and we never did get together again. And I understand he is very straight now. But I also understand that he's not playing anymore and that he's teaching, doing something. So I hope he is. But you see, he was guilty enough. He felt guilty enough. What am I going to do? I'm not his keeper. I can't use them when they're like that and when they're not doing the job.
Had you realized that he was on drugs? And did you consider saying, oh, that's okay, you can stay, you're still performing?
I just thought his playing was kind of weak.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't really do the job I imagined he could do. But I still waited, you know, in case he was going through a period of natural, you know, just not feeling up to par or something. And I'm patient, you know. And everybody protected him, of course. Wonderful group, you know.
You mentioned that you didn't drink, you didn't even have a glass of wine until you were 46.
Right.
Why not? Why not have some wine or an occasional drink?
My mother drank more beer than she needed to drink. And in the neighborhood that I lived in, I saw a lot of, although my family were not involved, I saw a lot of street fighting and a lot of stuff going on. And I didn't need it. I was afraid. I didn't want to be involved in anything less than a life where I could really know where I was, you know, coming from. And, you know, to this very day, I'm very conscious about knowing, you know, what's going on at all times.
What made you think then at age 46 that it was okay at that point to have a drink? Did you feel secure enough within yourself so that you knew you could drink in moderation?
I think that was probably it.
There was an article, well, I think you wrote in the 50s, and it was called I Turned Down the Gift of Sight.
Mm-hmm.
What was that about?
It was some money-hungry, overzealous, publicity-hungry club owner who put it in, and it was totally untrue. And he took something out of context to the point where brought a lot of unnecessary unhappiness to my family because they didn't understand it.
What was the story?
I just said then, as I say now, I am a grown, educated, secure human being who happens to be blind. And at this stage in my life, if there was any thought of getting my sight back, first of all, if it was successful, if the optimum of success were possible, I would still have to be totally re-educated. It's one thing to hear a car going by at 60 miles an hour. It's another thing to see it flash by your eyes, having never seen it for as many years as you've been shielded as a blind man. Reading and writing would be entirely different. The interpretation of color firsthand would have to be learned. If it were less than successful, my eyes may very well be disfigured. Out of this statement, he gathered that I had Good Samaritans offering to pay for the operation, and I was ungrateful enough to turn it down. And by the way, this is about the first time I've commented on it for all these years, because that story has lived with me for all these years, and there's so many other wonderful things to talk about.
But the one thing I don't understand about that article, had someone like offered to you to like give you their eyes or something?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. He was just a... I told you what he was. He's a publicity-hungry...
So it's the guy from the club who offered to do that. I see.
I don't know whether he wanted to do it or whether... No, I don't think he wanted to do it. I think he just kind of made up that somebody wanted to do it and that I had turned it down. It was just a way of... You know, I tell you, frankly, I would get a much broader attention from people involved in publicizing if I ran down Fifth Avenue sticking needles in my arms. But if I can't get recognized for music and as a person, recognition beyond that, I don't need any more than I needed this extraneous story that he cooked up.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about your life and your playing today. Thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure, and thank you. I hope we see you again.
My guest has been pianist George Shearing. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineer for this edition was Joyce Lieberman. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Sallet is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I are the producers of the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible in part with funds provided by Philadelphia-based Cigna Corporation, a provider of insurance and related financial services to businesses and individuals worldwide. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.